This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio. My guest this week is Temple University history professor Heather Thompson, a leading scholar on the U.S. criminal justice system. Heather Thompson, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me a little bit about your background.
Oh, well, let's see. As you mentioned, I'm a professor of history, and I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, and decided that I really wanted to study what had happened to our cities and what had happened to our labor movement. And the long story short is that eventually brought me to study prisons.
Did you always want to be a professor?
I'm not sure about that, but I definitely was always the person who wanted to know why something had happened. So being a professor was a logical leap.
And the focus on prisons, why that area of interest above all?
Well, originally and still, I'm really interested in civil rights and the struggles for greater equality in this country. And so that was the research I originally did. And then I decided that I wanted to do a history book about a really important civil rights event, which was the Attica prison uprising of 1971. And in the course of researching that book, it began to dawn on me that after Attica, something pretty remarkable happened in this country, which was a massive prison buildup. So I began to think about why that was, and that very quickly immersed me in this whole question of why we have this massive prison system in this country.
And why did it happen, and why did it happen after Attica?
Well, it's obviously a very complicated question. I think it is Attica, of course, does not create the prison buildup, but I do think that much of the activism of the 60s and 70s, which is extremely important for opening our democracy, also has this unintended effect of generating an extraordinary backlash. So much like after the Civil War, we get a real backlash to African-American demands on the polity and on the economy. After the Civil Rights 60s, we also get a real reaction to that. And the way it takes place in the 60s is in the form of a massive war on crime that is begun actually in 1965 before the crime rate becomes really serious, and it's begun by actually the Democratic administration of Lyndon Johnson.
A lot of people don't know that because they see Johnson war on poverty. They don't realize he did the war on crime, and people usually say that was Nixon.
Right, exactly. And frankly, that was a bit of a surprise to me. I had always taught and had always assumed that the war on crime was Nixon's baby, and it doesn't really start till 1968. And then it really became clear to me that we get, with Johnson, the Law Enforcement Administration Act and administration in 1965, which is essentially the apparatus, the foundation that makes this larger war on crime possible, right at the moment, by the way, that we're passing, and he's signing the Voting Rights Act of 1965.
I was going to say that's the ugly flip side of the civil rights laws that he was passing.
Exactly.
Interesting. Tell us a little bit about Attica for people who are listening who don't remember Attica and what Attica was.
So Attica was a very important prison rebellion that took place in September of 1971 in upstate New York. And the reason it was important was that it was a real all-out protest for better conditions for people who were incarcerated. And it was significant because it was very public. It was televised. The prisoners inside wanted to make sure that the nation was watching what had happened, that there would be observers to make sure that negotiations with the state went smoothly. But it's infamous because at the end of the day, Governor Nelson Rockefeller decided to order a forcible retaking of the prison over the objections of the guards inside, the prisoners inside, and the observers who were helping to facilitate negotiations. And it was ultimately a massacre. So it has sort of lived on as this moment we need to understand.
How many people died?
Well, 39 people were immediately killed or died shortly after the retaking. But the real story is bigger than that because so many people were wounded. I mean, 6, 7 gunshot wounds. And then after the retaking, there is a period of severe torture and abuse that goes on while there is full control taken already in the prison.
What kind of torture are you talking about?
Well, so it takes many years before this story really comes out. But essentially, after the state troopers take the prison back, they force everyone to strip naked and to essentially crawl and be prodded and pushed towards the cell block where they're going to be rehoused. But on the process, people are beaten with nightsticks. They run gauntlets. People play Russian roulette with them in their cells. People with extraordinary injuries don't receive medical care. People die simply because they don't receive medical care. So it's a really terrific moment of clash between state and citizens that significantly, has sort of been unremarked upon enough, I think.
Mm. And if someone's listening and they think, well, there's a prison uprising, what do you expect? You know, they got to bring the prison back under control. What was the prison like during the uprising?
So people would think, well, you know, why should we have any sympathy for what happens at Attica? And what's notable about this uprising is that the things that the people inside wanted were quite basic, right? To have, you know, have enough food to eat, to have enough resources to get through your day, to have religious freedom, to be able to practice basic human rights. And what is really interesting is that the way they began this rebellion, which was sort of in complete chaos, ends up in a very democratic uprising where there's actually people are electing representatives from each cell block to kind of to express what needs to happen in the prison. And at the end of the day, what's remarkable about it is that even the guards who had been taken hostage in this are basically saying to the state of New York, we need to respond to what's happening here. These people have legitimate grievances.
Were they mistreated, the guards?
Well, of course, in the initial hours of the uprising, it was complete chaos. A lot of people got hurt. But ultimately, the guards were surrounded by two circles of prisoners to make sure that they were protected. They were actually given beds when other people didn't have beds. They were fed. And so the guards were very clear that they had been treated pretty well. After all, this is a very chaotic event overall. But the feeling was that this was a negotiation that was happening with some degree of progress, and all parties wanted there to be a peaceful resolution. So that's why the retaking was so kind of horrific. It was came out of the blue and was quite bloody.
And why did Governor Nelson Rockefeller do that?
Well, there's a lot of speculation, but not the least of which is that he was very determined. He was a liberal Republican at a moment when the Republican Party was getting extraordinarily conservative. And many have suggested that Attica is really his moment to draw a line in the sand and to say, we are simply not going to negotiate with these people. And then, of course, he immediately is talking to Nixon and other high party officials about this moment, and he's getting congratulated and he's getting endorsed. So it's a very political decision, I think.
Hmm. I'm speaking with Professor Heather Thompson at Temple University. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. Professor Thompson's one of the leading scholars of the U.S. criminal justice system, the prison industrial complex. She's been working on this book on Attica for how long now?
Oh, it's almost about 9 years now.
It's
long
not
time.
On the shelf yet, though. When can we expect it?
Well, I'm hoping to send it to the press at the end of this year. It's interesting. One of the reasons this has taken so long is that this is a story that's very hard to get at. Shortly after the rebellion, there was a lot of effort to make sure that this full story was not made available. The records, there's thousands of boxes of materials related to Attica that the state of New York has, in part because there's been much litigation that's followed this. But it's very difficult to have. You cannot just walk into the archives and say, can I see box, 25? And the reason for this, of course, is that there's no statute of limitations on murder. There were many people killed at Attica, and to really tell the story is to kind of dig into this broader story of responsibility and so forth.
Were you able to get into those boxes?
Quite a few. I mean, I was able to come at this story rather from the sidelines. I mean, my mantra became who must have the copy, and then to spend all these years kind of tracking that down. And I was given enormous assistance by the attorneys of the prisoners, but also I've talked to the guards, I've talked to the state troopers. I've really tried to make it my mission to make this a story about everybody.
And you have been involved in a documentary on Attica. Tell me about that and how people might be able to see it.
Yeah, so this is just recently out. It's called Criminal Injustice, Death and Politics at Attica, and it's done by two very well-known filmmakers, Christine Christopher and David Marshall. And it's really about the politics of Attica, and it traces the cover-up, if you will. That's the terms that they use. And it's about a one-hour documentary, and it's definitely worth seeing, I think.
So if you're listening and you're interested in this Attica documentary, people should contact their local PBS station.
Exactly.
Moving beyond Attica, you focus a lot of attention in some of your scholarly work on the phenomenon, which is kind of unprecedented, of the mass incarceration in the United States in the late 20th century. What brought that on?
So, you know, in many respects, this is an issue that sociologists and criminologists have been spending quite some time looking at and trying to figure out how did we get where we are. But certainly for historians, this was the elephant in the room. So for me, working on the 1970s, it took me a minute to kind of really think about the way in which this entire nation moves in such a punitive direction in the 30 years after Attica and really the 40 years. And I had to kind of sort out what was happening. And most of my work these days is actually just trying to shine light on this crisis and to kind of get people to understand the magnitude of the crisis, because in ways that people don't, I think, appreciate, even if you could care less about those who are locked up, this is a carceral crisis that has eroded our cities. It has undermined our economy, and it really has distorted our democracy. And so I sort of see my work as trying to flesh that out for folks so that they understand the magnitude of what we face right now.
How has it distorted the democracy?
So this is sort of the hidden story. We have moved in the last 40 years to essentially there's more than 7 million people ensnared in this criminal justice system. There's more than 2 million people locked up in it. And what that has meant is that people who previously would have, for example, been able to vote, many of them are now disfranchised because they have a criminal record. We have 65 million people in this country with a criminal record now. So, of course, that's going to change our access to democracy. But there's also a hidden story here, which is that the U.S. Census counts people where they're incarcerated, not where they live. So when you have massive movement of people from, say, inner cities into rural upstate prisons, you fundamentally change representation and the political structure of this country. And we could talk a lot more about that, but I do think this is one of the kind of hidden secrets, the hidden costs of this carceral state that we've all kind of watched build while we were asleep.
So politically, in Democratic Republican terms, it tilts things toward the Republicans. It goes moves people to who are prisoners to Republican areas where they can't vote, but they're counted as a citizen there, and so they get more representation in that rural, largely Republican area.
Absolutely, and I think it's been documented very clearly by scholars of political science that this is exactly what happens. And again, it's sort of this alarming historical hearkening back to slavery in the Civil War. I mean, the Three-Fifths Clause, where someone's body, remarkably, an African-American body is counted for political power for white people when they themselves have no political power. It's a very alarming state for our democracy, and one I think it's important to think about.
And mass incarceration didn't come about because there's a sudden jump in violent crime, did it?
Well, there's a huge stake in trying to figure out why exactly we get this. Most people just assume, popular lore is, that we get a war on crime because crime in the 1960s just goes out of control. And part of my work is to kind of historicize crime. And in fact, when you look at crime rates over the course of the 20th century, what is most remarkable about the moment we get this federal bureaucracy to fight crime is that crime rates are still very unremarkable. The murder rate was higher around the Great Depression. It was higher at other moments in American history. And we do not get this carceral buildup. Now, true enough, we do get very high crime rates, certainly by the 80s and the 90s. But interestingly, it seems to happen right at the moment when the war on crime is at its most intense and most vigorous.
And some of it has to do with the war on drugs, too.
Exactly.
And how? What's that overlay?
Well, so, of course, the way we begin a major war on crime is we criminalize urban space, and the first line of doing this is the drug war. So making certain things illegal that had not been illegal before, or making the penalties for things that had been illegal before much more intense, is what immediately leads to these high rates of incarceration. But there's all this fallout from this, right? So we have in cities and in communities orphaned children as more and more parents are incarcerated, overwhelmingly for nonviolent crimes. So it has eroded our cities. It has emptied out entire city blocks that we now have a name for, which is the million-dollar block, right? What it costs to actually keep these people in prison.
So tell me about that. I'm not familiar with that term.
Yeah, so if you look at a city, like I'm from Detroit, and there's entire areas of the east side of Detroit, for example, where 1 in 22 people are under correctional supervision. And if you take that down even further to a neighborhood level, so the Brewer Park neighborhood in Detroit, 1 in, I believe, 12 people. I mean, it's a phenomenal concentration of incarceration.
So the million-dollar block would be the cost of everyone in that block
exactly.
to pay for them now that they're in prison.
Exactly. But yet if you look at the block, right, we see extraordinary poverty. We see a rise in childhood homelessness. The foster care system is cracking under the weight of this. So the social devastation that this wreaks creates enormous disruption. And so when we think about if we're really serious about fighting crime, then we are really going about this the wrong way.
Creating crime in a way.
Well, exactly.
Creating the conditions for crime.
And there's certainly, there's a lot of debate about this, but top criminologists, namely Todd Clear, have, I think, shown very conclusively that high rates of incarceration without question have what we call a criminogenic effect, that they create the conditions, as he says, that sustain crime.
Hmm. There's a vicious cycle if ever I heard one.
Exactly.
My guest today is Professor Heather Thompson, a historian at Temple University who studies mass incarceration in the United States and has a book coming out on Attica and has been involved in this documentary on PBS about Attica. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. You say this mass incarceration has undermined our democracy, and you explained a little bit about that, and you say it's undermined our economy, and you've talked a little bit about that. You also write that it's undermined the American labor movement.
Yeah. So we have, as historians, we've spent a lot of time trying to figure out why is the American labor movement weakened so much over the course of the 20th century. And again, there's many reasons for this, not the least of which is globalization and NAFTA and deindustrialization. But in my work, I want to suggest that there are other things going on and that we also need to pay attention to the growth of this massive carceral state. Not coincidentally, at the very moment when we get huge numbers of people in prison, businesses come together to try to access that labor in not a new way. The last time they had accessed it, again, was after the Civil War in the South when they needed labor because there was no more free slave labor. But during the New Deal, we sort of had all these regulations. You couldn't do that anymore. The labor
so they had
movement.
Prison labor after the Civil War, and
right.
We're doing prison labor now.
Right. After a moment when we didn't really have it so much because the labor movement after the Civil War wakes up and says we simply can't sustain our own livelihoods with this kind of job competition. So while the labor movement in some respect is asleep in the early 70s, we get businesses reaccessing prison labor. We also get not just this sort of an upping of the labor done in state and federal prisons, but also the ability for private companies to access this labor force.
Was there a change in the law that allowed that to happen?
Yes. There was literally a modification of these laws during the New Deal that had put prohibitions on, for example, selling prison-made goods across state lines or allowing private enterprise to access state or federal prisoners. So these things have been changed, and it has, I think, fundamentally changed our economy.
And do prisoners have the right to just say, I'm not going to do that?
Well, of course, as always, these things depend on different facilities in different states. But in general, we have a real problem because, often people don't have a choice. And also, of course, many prisoners, in fact, want to work. Prison is itself a very demoralizing and dehumanizing and boring experience. People want to be productive. So the problem, in my view, is not inherently labor. The problem is the exploitation. So both on the inside and the out. right? So for prisoners, they're exploited because they're paid little next to nothing.
What is a prison wage an hour?
Well, I mean, it depends. It is possible in some facilities to actually make minimum wage under federal regulations, but all of that is taken back in the form of housing and various other ways in which the wage is taken back. But most people, in fact, are making anywhere from 13 to 32 cents an hour. Now, why should we care? Because ultimately, when people get out, if they don't have any money and any place to live and anything to eat, this is where we get very high recidivism rates. Also, of course, they have many dependents, right? They have children. They have people who are back in those million-dollar blocks that need help. So there's exploitation inside, but then, of course, on the outside, workers on the outside are competing with these extraordinarily low wages and horrible working conditions, right? It's easier for a company to work someplace where OSHA is not particularly paying attention.
And so some of the biggest companies in the United States are farming stuff out to prisons to get their work done?
Well, increasingly. I mean, what's one of the interesting sub-stories here is that it used to be people were concerned about shipping labor to these maquiladoras over the border. And what's happening now is it's almost better to keep this labor within prisons, particularly in South Carolina. There's a lot of these new prison factories that you know, you give them a dollar and you have your tax abatement and so forth and so on. For example, many of us remember the BP oil spill, right, on the Gulf. And what people don't understand is that much of that cleanup was done, again, by prisoners. This is dangerous work. It was very toxic work.
The video that I saw, they weren't exactly wearing the proper masks and gloves either.
Exactly. But this is an area that's also very depressed, where there were people that would have done that work, but that work would have cost a lot more money, and it would have had to have been much safer.
There's another aspect of exploitation in prisons, and that is not only companies using the prison labor, but actual private companies owning the prisons. And to what extent is that a problem in your view?
Well, so this is really the thing that I think this nation should be particularly outraged by, because when you really break it down, we now have a situation where companies have enormous financial incentive to both build prisons and service them. That is to say, provide everything from tampons to telephones to tasers to these prisons. And you might say on the one hand, well, this is America. Everyone has a right to make a profit. This is free enterprise. But when you really break it down, what this means is that in order for someone to make money and in order for someone to profit, someone else has to be victimized. And whether that means it's someone on the ground that's had been the victim of a violent crime, or whether that's literally someone on the inside who's there for a nonviolent crime but for extraordinary lengths of time, thus orphaning their own children. So what kind of a society are we if we say that essentially I need people to be victimized to have my profit margin go up? It's quite disturbing, I think.
And a lot of these companies are making money hand over fist.
Absolutely. Both in private prisons and also detention centers, the combination is really horrifying.
Now, you've written a little bit about prison guards, Heather Thompson, and the thing that came to my mind before I read your article was just the common view that prison guards and prison guard unions are just so interwoven into this prison industrial complex that the union is much for building more prisons, even private prisons, as the owners of those prisons are, mm-hmm. or you know the most right wing Republican who wants to lock everybody up. But you seem to take that apart and find it not so valid. Why?
Well, I don't question that everyone who has a job would very much like to keep it. So we do have to acknowledge that people who work in prisons are a little concerned when we might decarcerate, when there might not be any more prisons. But when we actually break this down, we have to be really careful when we hang this on prison unions. There's no question corporations have an interest in this. But when we really look at what prison unions are arguing, and there are two exceptions to this, the California Peace Officers Union and Nioscoba in New York, which have been much more like sort of employee associations in some respect, even than unions, because they are instrumental and have been instrumental in some pretty stiff laws that have been passed, like three strikes in California. But in general, unions, if you look at what they're saying, if a prison's going to be closed, they're not saying we need to keep prisons open, just that's it, full stop. They're saying what we are worried about is if you close this prison, we know you're not going to let people out. We know you're not decarcerating. So what you're going to do is you're going to move all those bodies into the facility in the nearby town, which is going to cause enormous problems for us as workers, right? It's going to make the facility much more dangerous. It's going to create speed up. It's going to create terrible working conditions. So we as a union are concerned about the way in which you're just decarcerating, right? Because the union has working issues that it has to take into account. That's one issue. The other issue is that unions, in fact, are deeply opposed to prison privatization. Mm. AFSCME, for example, has time and again opposed the privatization of prisons because most private prisons are anti-union, right? So I think it's a complicated question, and it's the reason I think we have to bring the labor movement into this equation. The labor movement has to start dealing with this issue and deal with it holistically, right? Yes, prisons do provide some jobs, but far fewer than you would imagine, far less for the people that actually live in those towns where they go than those people had imagined. And ultimately, when you think about the unemployment penalty of having been incarcerated and how many people now are nearly unemployable because they have a criminal record, for the broader labor movement, we need to think much more broadly about how we're going to employ our citizens.
So what would you have the labor movement do on prison issues or on the prison industrial complex?
So they have to be much more, I think, attuned and aware than they are to what organizations that corporations are in, such as ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, is doing. They need to be lobbying much more clearly for regulation of this kind of prison labor that's going on, like they did during the 20s and in the 30s. And they need to be much more careful about who they see as workers that they might represent, right? Because at the end of the day, this is not going to be about an elite working class. This is going to be about all of the people, whether they are cleaning hotel rooms or cleaning gutters or building cars, that work for a living. And an extraordinary percentage of those people now have a criminal record. So this is their constituency.
Yeah, it's part of the broader American labor movement.
Exactly.
We only have about a minute and a half left. You also talk, Professor Thompson, about the school-to-prison pipeline. And if you could just address that, because I think that's crucial as well.
Right. So the way we build up this huge carceral state, as I said, is by criminalizing urban space. And one of the key places where that's happened most intensely is our nation's schools. And the effect of this has been devastating. Not only does it take children out of schools and put them into the juvenile justice system very early in life for things that, again, students have always done wrong, truancy and writing on the desk and things like that.
Huck Finn would have put in prison.
Exactly. But it also has changed our educational institutions and made them very difficult places to learn. And so when we talk about our dropout rates and we talk about why American kids are not achieving as they should, this is yet another reason why we need to look at the carceral state.
What can people do who are listening who want to fight this prison industrial complex?
Well, I think the first thing we all have to do as citizens is to just really resist this temptation to fight crime with this very punitive approach. If we're really serious about the safety of our neighbors and ourselves, we need to start reinvesting in our communities. And this is not just some, you know, liberal kind of olden day wish list. It's fundamentally about rebuilding these communities that frankly, 40 years of this carceral policy have completely destroyed.
Hmm. Well, it's been fascinating talking with you, Professor Thompson. My guest today has been Heather Thompson of Temple University. You've been listening to Progressive Radio. It's great talking to you.
Thank you so much.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.